Good afternoon and welcome to State of the News on WFPL. I'm Gabe Bullard. I'm here with the WFPL News team, Philip Bailey, Devin Katayama, and Erica Peterson. And let's get right into it. Philip, it's no secret the city is facing some pretty significant budget shortfalls for this fiscal year and the coming fiscal year. And the mayor's talking about cuts. He's been talking about cuts for quite some time now. And the Metro Council offered some suggestions this week.
Yes. To give everyone some background, Metro government faces over the next two fiscal years a $42 million deficit. The way that's explained is that right now, the current fiscal year that we're in, there is already a $12 million shortfall that has to be filled by June 30th. There's a projected, on top of that, another $30 million shortfall for next year. So with two quarters left, city leaders are beginning to scramble, at least meet and talk about ways in which there are cuts to make in order to fill that, which they're obligated to do by law. So Louisville Metro Council President Jim King sent a letter to Mayor Fisher, a six-page letter with recommendations from Metro Council members after meeting with leaders of the Budget Committee and other city lawmakers, and it included some pretty interesting things. I mean, some things you probably wouldn't have seen in the past. For example, canceling or amending the contract with Greater Louisville, Inc., which is the city's Chamber of Commerce, rerouting funds from the Downtown Development Corporation, merging the fire and EMS departments, which is probably the biggest thing of the suggestions.
Right, now, that's something that had been talked about a little bit with the Merger 2.0 task force. Some of these mergers might happen.
Yeah, the task force had talked about that, and even before then, during former Mayor Abramson's terms, there was conversations about merging all of the fire departments, not having those suburban departments, merging all of them to save money. That was really more of a state issue, though, and it was a bit more complicated. One of the more interesting things that raised a few eyebrows was the council's suggestion that the city begin collecting occupational taxes from performers who come to the KFC Yum Center. And many people probably don't realize that those entertainers who have been there are not paying taxes. They got this idea really from professional basketball. Each time an NBA player or goes to a different city, they pay the different taxes of that municipality and or state. So that's a suggestion. That's something that the Arena Authority has opposed since before the arena was actually built and opened.
And you talked with Councilman Kelly Downard. He doesn't think that would be any sort of deterrent from somebody to actually come to the Yum Center.
No, he broke it down like this. And Councilman Downard, a Republican from the 16th District, as a former banker, he loves numbers. He broke it down by saying that someone who's making $1 million by coming here to Louisville, booking and coming here to Louisville for an act, is not going to not come simply because they're being taxed $22,000. They just won't do it, according to him. But clearly, this is something that we hadn't seen before, and it raised a few eyebrows.
And you mentioned GLI. There's a recommendation that the city cut some of its money to GLI. There's been a lot of criticism around GLI and this $1 million the city gives to the organization every year. In that economic development review that the mayor ordered, there was no call to end the contract. The mayor's office said, well, they performed the service of going out and reaching out to businesses faster than government could without some of the hindrances that they say government has, and it's really worth more than $1 million. But the council has not always echoed that, right?
Yeah, well, given, I mean, GLI has faced a number of criticisms, particularly in the past year and a half, really stemming from the mayoral race. Before that, there was criticism, but it was really underneath a lot of the media coverage. And I think what you see overall is that people are acknowledging the lost decade here in Louisville, where we actually lost private sector jobs from 2000 to 2010. And people are looking for someone to blame, and oftentimes people point the finger to GLI. Whether that's fair or unfair is really left up for debate. But at this point, I think the council has demonstrated when they held half of the money and at the last budget hearings last year, where they held half of the funding for GLI, I think you see city lawmakers much more willing now to publicly criticize the city's Chamber of Commerce and question its utility, given the fact that before the recession began, you saw Louisville on a downward trend as far as job attraction, job creation.
And what's been the mayor's office's reaction to these suggestions? Are they going to take them into advisement?
Mayoral spokesman Chris Pointer said they didn't want to react to any specific points. They overall, however, say that they are happy about the recommendations. They're taking them in stride. Certainly, they're already talking to department heads about their thoughts. They're talking to Metro employees. In fact, the mayor just recently solicited citizen input via social networking, via his Twitter and Facebook account. So they're culminating, they're getting a lot of different people involved. Next week is when the mayor will meet with his senior staff, and they will actually begin the process of drafting the budget. But this will be added as many different recommendations start to come in.
All right, and that's something we'll make sure to keep watching, and I'm sure you'll keep us up to date on what the mayor's considering among these suggestions and what the council's reaction is. We're going to go over to education news now. And Devin, I've noticed you've been walking around the office carrying this big document that you've been reading, some of your you know, winter reading list here.
I just want to show you the size of this thing, Gabe. It's over 500 pages. This is the curriculum management audit provided by Phi Delta Kappa International, which was the auditing firm that was hired by JCPS to basically do a curriculum management audit across the whole district. And they were in the district in October of last year for 1 week to meet with hundreds of staff members and review piles of documents. As you can see, this is quite the document itself. Inside it essentially says that JCPS needs to redevelop its curriculum. The teachers are teaching a wide variety of things that aren't necessarily to the test. What they recommend is that they tighten that curriculum up, the written curriculum, so teachers know exactly what they need to teach to. And once they know, they'll be able to go outside their boundaries, use various resources, and then encapsulating all that will teach to the test that they're going to be taking this spring.
And so it's a form of teaching to the test, but teaching toward these other skills that students need to have, or this other knowledge, not necessarily just the multiple.
Right, and that's choice. Also part of the Common Core state standards that are going in this year as well. I think that may help them do this and develop this in the future years. It's going to take a while. There's a lot of information in here, a lot of different ways they can start. One of the first recommendations was offered last fall, and they have already started to do that, which is reorganize the central administration office. There's four chief positions that will be directed to the streamlining communications to the superintendent. They're beginning to hire for those positions. And once they have those in place, they'll be able to spread out and do the rest of the stuff that's in here.
Right. One thing they found was that there were possibly too many people or some confusion around how many administrators there needed to be in the central office.
Right. There's a lot of people doing a lot of different things. Some of it wasn't managed. Some of them didn't have oversight. Some of the staff members didn't have oversight. They found that the job descriptions for a lot of the staff members were adequate. Their job descriptions were adequate, but the job descriptions themselves did not really provide them with goals so that they knew what kind of success or, progress they were making while doing their own job. And now there's 800 interventions or programs that the district offers throughout the district. Those also are not being really managed or watched in an adequate way. So they recommended that the district find a way to kind of assess those.
How long will this implementation take?
Certain things in the recommendations will take 3 to 6 months, like developing the central administration, getting that in place. Other things will take a while, 3 years to develop the 3-year plan. It could take a few years. Once they have that plan in place, then we should start to see some more progress in the long term. Now, school districts that usually have these audits, they revisit them every 6 to 7 years. That's what Dr. John Murdoch, who was the lead auditor, that's what he said. He also recommended that they have an outside auditor come in while this process is going on and just to kind of manage them while this process is going on. A lot of people asked about accountability and how this process was going to, you know, stay open and transparent. So that's one way that he said it could.
And how will they be making sure that this works, that this audit is, one, implemented, and two, is successful?
Well, Dr. John Murdoch was saying it's going to take the district leaders, the board members, to keep the information open. He praised Dr. Superintendent Donna Hargens, who he actually worked with at Wake County with their audit. And he said that she has done a great job so far with keeping that information transparent, and that's going to need to continue. And I think the media has a role in this as well, to get accurate, good information out there. So that'll be something that we're going to need to kind of keep on track of.
And we certainly will here at WFPL. And speaking of schools, you also reported this week on some new nutrition standards for school lunches.
Yeah, I mean, these standards have not been updated in 15 years, and the standards are based on the Dietary Standards Guidelines for Americans, which is updated every 5 years. Now, I talked to the USDA. They said when the guidelines are updated every 5 years, not too much changes. But in 2005, that wasn't the case. A lot changed. That's when the USDA started making recommendations, but they weren't mandated. So this week, Michelle Obama was in Virginia. She announced these new standards, which will essentially reduce sodium over a level of time. Like, I think it's a 10-year period, and it will double the amount of fruit that's offered, and it will increase the whole grains that are used in schools. And I was over at Jefferson County Public Schools earlier, And they are already doing things to kind of meet these standards. In fact, they've been doing it for years. And the Julia Boucher, who's the nutrition director, says that they're almost already there where they need to be. That's because they've had several programs in place, a lot of education around the culinary arts, and they have been implementing whole wheat. They have a huge nutrition service center, which is out off 65 going south, and I visited that. They're able to basically produce things in mass quality and quantity and then distribute that out through the district. She said that helps them kind of keep all the recipes in line together when they do go out to the 60,000 lunches daily.
So what might be some of the changes from, like, what would be a typical meal before these recommendations? What's the typical meal like at JCPS? What will it become?
You'll see a lot more fruit on the plate, essentially. And in fact, color of fruit. They're now requiring certain colored fruit, the dark green and an orange color, to be and vegetables, I should say, too. That gets grouped in, and I think it gets confused sometimes. Before, and this will stay in place as well, tomato paste is keeping its nutritional value. You might have heard a lot of headlines that said mm-hmm. pizza will continue being counted mm-hmm. as a vegetable. That's because the pizza that they serve now is technically counted as a vegetable because the serving size of the tomato paste is small enough, but because the paste is counted as a larger amount, it can be counted as a whole vegetable.
And you went out, you mentioned this nutrition center where they're preparing this food in this kitchen. You went out and visited that. We'll put a link to the story about your visit on the website when the show is posted. Mm-hmm. Did you try any of this? Was it up to a standard?
Well, I hung out with their chef. They contracted a chef, Jim Whaley, to basically reduce sodium while maintaining the flavor profile, because students, and actually, you know, I'm picky too, you know, if something changes, I don't necessarily like it. He was trying to add more local produce to the menu, to the spaghetti sauce that he was trying out. He actually told me that it was bland to him, but he's not really the judge. What happens is JCPS takes his recipe to the schools, and they have these little nutrition councils where students meet regularly, quarterly, I should say, and they try the samples themselves. Now, I went to one of these samplings this week, and the students felt like there wasn't enough vegetables in them, which was interesting. And it might have just been because I was there, and they kind of knew why they were there mm-hmm. with the council. So they might not be the best judge and best reporter for what, you know, they really think. But that's kind of how they continue to maintain being able to give students what they want.
All right. That's something we'll keep an eye on, too, as JCPS continues to try to improve its nutrition. And turning now to you, Erica Peterson, lots of MSD news this week, as usual in most weeks. First, the board has a new ethics policy.
They do. They finally have a new ethics policy. Are you tired of hearing about the MSD yet?
Getting there, maybe. there was a lot of consideration over it. I mean, it seems like there were a number of stories out there that brought this on, that called for an ethics policy, then a number of stories about drafting the ethics policy, then considering the ethics policy.
Yeah, and one of the reasons is that this has been going on for a long time. The board started talking about an ethics policy this summer when they knew that an audit was going to be coming out, but they weren't really sure what would be in the audit yet. But they knew that there were going to be some ethical issues that were addressed. So they started drafting this ethics policy, and they came up with a draft, I believe, in September or October. And then it pretty much sat there for a while. And then, of course, last year in December, Auditor Crit Llewellyn released a state audit that brought up numerous problems with MSD, including some ethical problems, some managerial problems. And now that the board has these recommendations in front of them, they have a new interim executive director, and they were able to sit down and address kind of all of the issues into one ethics policy. And it's a big one. It's 16 pages. Which I think it was one or two back in September or October when they started this process.
And what all is in this policy that they ended up passing?
Well, this policy, for one, it applies to the board, and it also applies to the senior MSD officials. So the executive director, the chief engineer, a couple of the top people. It's pretty much what you would expect to see in an ethics policy. It sets out ways that just to avoid perceptions of conflicts of interest. It does not allow anyone who's in these positions to do any business on the side with MSD, hold MSD contracts. There's kind of a what they call a revolving door provision for 3 months for the senior staff and 12 months for the board, where you can't just end your time at MSD for whatever reason and then turn around and do something that is regulated by MSD, requires a contract with MSD, things like that. So that's kind of to for a cooling your heels kind of period to avoid that perception of impropriety.
And also, you mentioned some of the leadership changes at MSD. The task force that the mayor formed to look at a possible merger with the water company, they met for the first time this week.
They did. And this meeting was largely a nuts and bolts kind of meeting. The task force was appointed by Mayor Fisher, and it has a bunch of people from the city who are experts in different areas. There are some people who know about water, some about wastewater, some about finance, some about nonprofits. So it's kind of an eclectic group of people. And they're supposed to be researching possible collaborations between the water company, MSD, and Metro Public Works. And this could be anything from a complete merger of some of those entities to kind of just like a sharing, where maybe it would make sense to merge the IT departments, for example, and have all that in one place. So they did meet, and they will keep on meeting for the next couple of months and present their recommendations to Mayor Fisher.
All right, and we'll count on you to keep us up to date on that and how these talks go and what they end up doing. Philip, lastly, for this segment, we'll turn to you. This is a story that's been developing, this election finance, campaign finance story around Mayor Greg Fisher, and businessman Ed Hart has joined in with some evidence.
I think it's safe to say that the splinter in Mayor Fisher's foot about this issue has now turned into a thorn, perhaps. Little businessman Ed Hart has basically come out with and submitted documents to the Kentucky Registry of Election Finance saying that Mayor Fisher misled donors about their contributions to his inauguration and how they were spent. The initial complaint was filed by activist and Metro Council candidate Curtis Morrison. In that case, it alleges that the mayor pulled a bait and switch of sorts by soliciting funds for last year's inauguration and then using those funds for his mayoral campaign to pay off his personal campaign debt, which I believe is about $250,000. Mm-hmm. Now, Mayor Fisher's attorney, Jennifer Moore, she said in her response to Morrison's complaint that the checks were deposited and reported pretty properly, pretty accurately. She says that, you know, if you look at Hart's and other contributors' checks, they all say in the memo payable to Greg, quote, Greg Fisher for mayor. The problem with that, according to Mr. Hart, is that they were told to do that by Tommy Elliott, who was the mayor's chief fundraiser, told to put those funds and mark them as for the campaign, even though that they were going to the inauguration. At least that's what they believed. So at this point, Mr. Hart is really, I mean, using some pretty harsh language here, saying that the mayor not only is misleading voters, but that rather than admitting he used them for the wrong purpose, he's mounting sort of a scurrilous defense. He's basically saying that his defense is accusing him and others of lying or misleading people as well. So, you know, Hart is pretty upset about this, and he still hasn't gotten a response to whether the mayor is going to return those funds to charity or whether he's going to keep them, as Mr. Hart said, in his own pocket. And one thing that was interesting was that Hart was the one who brought up Mayor Fisher's wealth, saying that why is a wealthy individual like Mayor Greg Fisher not wanting to return these funds so they can go to charity? Why does he want to use them to pay off his campaign debt?
All right, this is a story we'll keep following on WFPL, and you're listening to State of the News on WFPL. We're going to take a break now. I want to thank the WFPL News team, Philip Bailey, Erica Peterson, Devin Katayama. We'll be back with a look at news across the state and in Indiana in just a moment. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Gabe Bullard. I'm joined now with Kentucky Public Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief, Kenny Colston. Kenny, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Gabe.
All right. Here, we'll get into it. There's been a lot of frustration over redistricting this week in Frankfort.
Yes, there has. In fact, it's gotten to the point where lawsuits are being filed trying to stop the maps from taking place from people running in these new districts. House Republicans have been very upset with their lines. A few Senate Democrats, most notably Senator Kathy Stein in Lexington, very upset with how the Senate drew their lines. They're taking it to the courthouse, taking their arguments, their talking points to Franklin County Circuit Court, and are hoping to have an injunction to put a hold on these new maps, to put a hold on the filing deadline and new candidates and new districts on Monday morning, because the filing deadline is Tuesday all day long.
And we should, for some background here, these are the new districts that have been drawn based on the census data. The minority party in each chamber is saying essentially that they've been that the maps are unfair to them, that they've been drawn to possibly encourage some or actually push some lawmakers out by putting them into primaries with each other, or in the case with Kathy Stein, the senator of Lexington, being completely drawn out of her district.
You're absolutely right. Republicans control the state Senate. Democrats control the state House. In the House, there's been, the most egregious is in Bowling Green. There's three Republican representatives who are looking to, they would have to run against each other. Of course, one of them is now going to run for a state Senate seat that was drawn specifically for him after it came out that he was going to have a really tough primary. And then, like you said, Senator Stein is now, would have to be the representative from the Moorhead area in order to stay in the state Senate. That can't be the case. She hasn't lived there for a year. And so, yes, it is the minority parties. There's also some private citizens. I think some Fayette County, Lexington area citizens are looking to join the lawsuit. There are some Republican private citizens who filed with the House Republicans yesterday for their lawsuit. So there are some private individuals that are also concerned. Of course, legislative leaders, House Speaker Greg Stumbo, and the Republicans in the state Senate have said that their maps are constitutional. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been able to vote and pass them. And so they maintain that what they did is perfectly fine and fair.
And what about the new congressional districts for Kentucky's six delegations to the House of Representatives?
Well, depending on who you talk to, that's either moving down the pipe or not moving at all. House Speaker Greg Stumbo seemed to indicate this week that was moving along a little bit, and then when I spoke with the Senate Republicans, notably Senator Robert Stivers, he said that Greg Stumbo's latest map moved nothing at all. The only thing they seem to be able to agree on is today they agreed to move that filing deadline to February 7th. That's a week after what it was supposed to be. It's supposed to be Tuesday, January 31st, like for legislative and judicial seats. And so they have agreed to push back the filing deadline. Stumbo says that if they can't get an agreement in time for that February 7th filing deadline, then there's probably not going to be an agreement this year, and there could be court battles, but most likely that they'll have to run in the current districts, and maybe they'll try next session or in 2014. That's where congressional redistricting stands. There's a lot of movement in the 5th congressional district. That's where most of the arguments are. Some people believe that if Congressman Hal Rogers, when he retires, that area could be a Democratic pickup. And that seems to be what the arguing points are over. The Republicans obviously do not want to give Democrats a potential pickup maybe 10 years down the road. And Democrats see that as an opportunity to maybe get it back to a 3-3 congressional divide, where it's currently 4-2 in favor of Republicans.
With all this talk about redistricting, it seems like we haven't heard too much about the big issue going into the session, expanded gaming, the gambling bill. What's the status there?
Well, it appears that the gaming bill, we've heard it a million times, that it's coming this week. It's coming this week. I really do believe that it is coming next week. I believe that there was probably an effort to wait until after the filing deadline. Lawmakers, especially in these even-numbered years, do not like to vote on anything controversial before the filing deadline. The reasons are obvious. They don't want to have an opponent, a primary opponent, or a tough general election opponent that can run against them on a single controversial issue. In this case, it's the gambling vote. So I believe, that filing deadline, like we've said a million times, is Tuesday. I believe we could see something in the middle of next week, late next week, from the governor. It appears that he's going to get a boost and have Republican State Senator Damon Thayer either sponsor or co-sponsor this eventual amendment. They've agreed on the language, and now it's just a matter of working those votes.
Do they have the votes at present to pass it?
I'm not really sure. There's a few groups that are saying they don't. The Family Foundation of Kentucky, which is an obvious opponent of this bill, have said that they are three votes short and have said this week that if the amendment wasn't filed this week, it was likely dead. That being said, obviously they're advocating for the defeat of that. Bashir has tried to make it seem like it's inevitable that they'll have a vote on the gambling amendment. The Family Foundation is trying to do the opposite of that. They're trying to make sure that it's dead on arrival. The governor has not come out and said how many votes he has, and Thayer has said that it's going to be close. I tend to believe Thayer a little bit more. They may be a few votes short. I don't know that it's monumental, but other people would disagree with me. So it's really up in the air. They're probably around a 20 number, three votes short, but it's hard to say how squishy those extra three votes are.
All right. And what about another one of the governor's top legislative priorities here, the dropout bill, the bill to raise the dropout age?
The dropout bill is obviously has gone through the House Education Committee and is just waiting on the House floor. There's no doubt that it will eventually pass the House. It has previously. The situation is that in the state Senate, the education chairman there, Senator Ken Winters, has said that the dropout bill probably has its best chance to pass this session. He co-sponsors a bill with Senator Jack Westwood of Northern Kentucky that does a few tweaks to the dropout bill that Beshear supports. It would provide local control. School board districts would decide whether or not to raise their dropout age to 18 or not. It wouldn't be a statewide referendum like Beshear wants. So that being said, it would give local control or state boards to say whether they want to do it or not. It also requires schools to show the Kentucky Board of Education they have some kind of alternative or technical education program for potential dropouts. Now, of course, here in Jefferson County, we do have alternative schools. So, for example, JCPS could basically tell the State Board of Education, here's our alternative schools. This is what we'll do, send potential dropouts to, and we want to raise our dropout age to 18 years old, just as a hypothetical. I talked with the sponsor of the House bill, Representative Greer, and he said he hasn't really got to read that Senate bill yet. He's looking at it to see if he would be okay with that, but he kind of signaled that he wasn't exactly in favor of that local control option. So it'll be interesting to see if they can work out a compromise, but at least the Senate is open to dealing with the dropout bill.
All right. Thank you very much for that, and we'll make sure to get the latest updates from you as they happen. Kentucky Public Radio Capitol Bureau Chief Kenny Colston, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Gabe.
This week, we heard a startling story from western Kentucky. The mayor of Hickman, a town southwest of Paducah, was murdered. We're joined by Shelley Baskin now from WKMS in Murray. Shelley, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Gabe.
And so what happened with this case?
Well, according to the Hickman Police Chief, Tony Grogan, about 1 a.m. on Monday morning, Hickman's mayor, Charles Murphy, was at home alone. A man armed with a shotgun broke into his house, and Chief Grogan says a witness reported hearing some gunshots around that time. The witness looked out and saw a man leaving the mayor's house, driving away in a pickup truck, phoned the police, and told them about what happened. They said that around that time at the police station, a man walked in, fitting the witness's description, and said and told the police there that he had shot the mayor, and he was turning himself in for the murder. They arrested him there. The man's name was Tommy Lattice. He was a semi-permanent resident of the town. And so they went over and checked and found that the mayor's front door had been broken in and found him shot in his bedroom. Right now they've got Lattice in jail on a $1 million bond and don't plan on releasing him.
Was there any sort of motive around it?
Well, from what Chief Grogan was saying, that Lattice didn't give a motive when he was arrested, but apparently Mayor Murphy had been dating Lattice's adopted mother, Carol Lattice, off and on again for the past few years. So they didn't want to say that it was definitely a personal issue, but it's hard to believe it wouldn't be just due to the relationship between the two men.
So this wasn't a break-in that went wrong or anything like that. It's believed there was some sort of premeditation around this.
Yes, they think that there was, a reason that he was there, and the reason was to kill Mayor Murphy.
And Hickman is a fairly small town. What's been the reaction to it around Hickman?
Well, yeah, Hickman's a really small town. It's about 2,800 people, and even the county it's in is only about Fulton County is only about 7,700 people, and it's one of those places where most of the people are going to know each other. I talked to the city manager Larry Myatt the day afterwards, and he was saying, it was one of those things that everybody was shocked and just totally unexpected for the area. And and just speaking on how small the town is, the mayor pro tem for the town right now is David Lattice, who is actually the adopted cousin of the shooter, Tommy Lattice. So, I mean, it's that gives you, you know, kind of a scale of how small a town is. Just everybody knows everybody, and it was fairly shocking for most of the people there.
And so what's next for the town, and what's next for the case?
Well, right now, they've had the arraignment for Tommy Lattice, and he pled not guilty at that point. Right now, they've still, of course, got him in jail. As far as the town goes, when I was speaking to the city manager, Myatt, he said that right now they're going to keep the mayor pro tem as David Lattice. As time goes on, here within the next few weeks, they'll be holding a city commission meeting to vote for the mayor's replacement for the rest of his term. And then after that, you know, they'll proceed with elections as usual.
All right. Thank you very much for being here, Shelley.
Yeah, it was my pleasure. Thank you.
And now we turn to the Indiana State House, where controversial right-to-work legislation has passed. We're joined by Brandon Smith with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Brandon, this was a fairly contentious bill. Can you get us up to speed on this?
Right. This passed in the House Wednesday, 54-44, with five Republicans voting against it.
And this is the legislation that Republicans have largely favored. It would essentially make it no longer a requirement if someone is working in a union shop to have to pay union dues. And this prompted walkouts last year from House Democrats and walkouts this year. What happened? There were some boycotts from the House Democrats. What ended up happening to get this legislation passed?
Well, I think this year the legislation was always going to get passed. The goal of the walkouts last year was to put right to work on the back burner for another year, that there were so many other issues going on in the legislature that they didn't want to jeopardize everything else over right to work. This year, right to work was, from the outset, the number one priority of Republican leadership. So I don't think the goal of Democratic walkouts this year was to kill the bill necessarily. They wanted to delay it as long as they possibly could, try to get more information, more education, more public input out to people. And I think they did that for as long as they could, and then they just simply couldn't do it anymore.
And so the vote was pretty contentious. For one period of time, didn't they prop the door open to hear some of the protests from outside?
Yes, this was part of Democrats claimed that the PA system in the hallway just outside the House chamber wasn't working very well. And that people outside couldn't hear, though, of course, with the chanting, it could have been much, much louder, and they still couldn't have heard. And they cited a rule in the Constitution that says the doors of the chamber must be open at all times. So they did prop open the doors, and initially some Republicans went back there to try and maybe not stop them, but to disagree with them. But the Speaker just decided to let it go. He said he wanted to move forward, not get hung up on doors being open or not, and just move on with the debate. So you could hear the protesters a lot louder in the chamber. They pretty much booed and chanted throughout all the Republicans who'd got up to talk about the bill, and stayed mostly silent for the Democrats.
And what are the prospects of this now that it has cleared the House?
Extremely strong. It goes to the Senate next week. The Senate is moving up their schedule a little bit. Normally they wait until they're finished with all Senate bills before taking up a House bill. But they've decided they want to get it done before the Super Bowl. So Monday they will have a committee hearing. Tuesday it'll be the amendment process on the floor. And Wednesday, if everything goes smoothly, of course, Wednesday would be passage. And it would go straight to the governor's desk if they don't make any changes, which they're not expected to.
And so if this ends up passing, if it gets signed, when would it take effect?
It takes effect on passage. So as soon as the governor signs it, Indiana will be a right-to-work state.
All right. Thank you very much, Brandon Smith, reporter with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations. Thanks a lot for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
There's one story from the Kentucky General Assembly that we overlooked in our chat with Kenny Colston, and that was the Senate's discussion of a resolution praising the Newport Aquarium and Penguin Palooza. To lobby for this, the aquarium brought in an actual penguin. We hear its name was Paula the Penguin, and this penguin was in the Senate, and I don't think Paula was very happy about redistricting. Let's hear this exchange between Senator Campbell and Senate President Williams.
This chamber supported the Tourism Development Act and also amendments thereto over the years that have enabled the Newport on the Levee, and in
Are
particular
you
the Newport.
The penguin that just defecated on the floor over there? Is that the penguin? Is that the penguin you're talking about?
Actually, Senator, I believe that's your desk.
Back in a moment on State of the News. Welcome back to State of the News on WFPL. I'm joined now by Rick Edmonds. He's the business analyst with the Poynter Institute. And this week and over weeks prior, we've heard a lot and seen a lot of presidential debates for the Republican contenders for office, really over just the last few months, even into last year. And one thing that the Poynter Institute has been following has been crowd participation. Rick, you attended one of these debates, correct?
Yeah, I was there on, was it Monday night? I guess it was Monday night. And an interesting part of that story, because the one I went to was really quite sedate, and it had a relatively small audience, a small auditorium, and many business executives as well as party dignitaries. And Brian Williams asked people to kind of hold their applause, and they did. But I think by contrast, the CNN and Fox have said within the last week or so that they think a lot of crowd participation kind of makes it a more exciting event, so they've been encouraging that.
And this crowd participation, even last year we heard a little bit about it previously, when there was some talk over whether or not the audience was, say, cheering, some talk of the death penalty, booing talk about a gay soldier. And this has really come to a head. It came to a head first with Newt Gingrich and John King getting into it about a question.
You're right that's on both of those points, that the sort of a hazard of that is that you don't know what the crowd's going to cheer for, and they might boo, or they might cheer in what seem like very inappropriate places to some watchers or listeners. I do think the John King example was pretty notable, too, and not really the first instance of that. There are a couple other debate hosts where Gingrich particularly has, you know, kind of done an attack the media thing, and that's part of his campaign, part of his persona, I guess.
And he said he wouldn't participate in other debates, right? Without if it were to be like the NBC debate where the crowd couldn't cheer and participate.
He said that. I take that with a little bit of a grain of salt. Romney had indicated right after South Carolina he wasn't sure whether he would participate in the Florida debates, but of course he did, and he actually did pretty well in them.
And speaking of the debates, yesterday there was crowd participation. We're going to hear a clip now of Newt Gingrich, Wolf Blitzer, and Mitt Romney there at the end.
This is a nonsense question. How about if the four of us...
You make a serious accusation against Governor Romney like that.
Suggested...
You need to explain that.
You want to try again? I mean,
wouldn't it be nice if people didn't make accusations somewhere else that they weren't willing to defend here?
Okay. All right.
And that's some of that back and forth. You hear the cheers for Newt Gingrich attacking the media. And it seems like a lot of the cheering and a lot of the booing lately has been in regard to the media, with Newt Gingrich criticizing debate moderators, Newt Gingrich criticizing the media in general, something of a bit of red meat for certain people he may be speaking to. But really, what's been the reaction that you've seen, at least through the media, of people, of reporters even, who hear these folks cheering and booing about their own work?
Well, I think there's been quite a lot written lately, maybe more in opinion columns than as news coverage, but sort of noted in the news coverage that, you know, this tactic is a part of how Gingrich is positioning himself. A very, very caustic editorial about Gingrich in the New York Times, or column, I should say, by Tim Egan this morning. And he wants to put out a persona of somebody who sort of shares the feelings, I guess you might say, including the biases against the media that a lot of Republican voters feel right now, and seemed to work for him very well in South Carolina.
And do you think that this is going to end up, that this is going to last, that these debates are still going to be like this? I had seen one report, some of the numbers for cable news debates have started to decline as certain candidates get out of the race. We're down to four people on stage, generally, Ron Paul, Rick Santorum, Newt Gingrich, right, and Mitt Romney. And the cable debates are starting to, the audiences at least, are starting to decline for people watching them. Do you expect that these debates are going to get a little less raucous as, you know, as these primaries wear on and as one front runner or even one nominee eventually emerges?
I think that's a possibility, and I think the clip you played from last night suggests that both Blitzer and Romney were pretty much lying in the weeds waiting for this, because Blitzer persisted in his question, and Romney used it as a lever to, you know, ask Gingrich if he really thought this, why he wouldn't be willing to discuss it. And you know, it's I think it's possible that it will run its course some for him, especially now it's been so widely noted as you know, something that's pretty calculated, as opposed to he just suddenly feels very indignant.
Does this portend anything for the general election debates that will come up between the eventual nominee and President Obama? Do you think that these are going to be more raucous than presidential debates tend to have been in the past, or will it completely have mellowed out by then?
Well, I'd say it depends a lot on the candidate. I think Romney would be similar as a debater to Obama, and Obama is, of course, very controlled most of the time, and at least my recollection is he was in the debates as well. Gingrich, I think, should he be the nominee? Yeah, I think there are going to be a lot of fireworks, you know, you might say we haven't seen anything yet.
What does this mean for the essentially the establishment of the debate when it becomes more of, say, an entertainment sort of function on cable news versus something that is an actual policy discussion?
My personal preference is more toward, I guess you'd say, the traditional format and devote really making the candidates and what they have to say the centerpiece of the show, and not taking up a lot of time with the interruptions of cheering. But not everybody sees it that way, and certainly you can argue that this is a year we're really in a way continuing what the Tea Party was all about, where particularly again on the Republican side, a lot of people are just angry about a lot of things, and so it's not unnatural for that to kind of play out in the debates.
All right. Thank you very much. Rick Edmonds is the business analyst with the Poynter Institute. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Okay. Enjoyed it. Thank you.
All right. Now, if you use Gmail, you got a message this week about new privacy policies. These policies are upsetting many users. And to get a handle on it, we turn to Steve Henn with NPR. Thanks for being here, Steve.
Sure thing.
All right. And I want to start with Steve. We can start with you if you just want to run down what this new privacy policy is for Google products, Gmail, Google Plus, and all of the various products they offer.
Yeah, well, Google had and still has something like 70 different privacy policies for different products. So YouTube has its own privacy policy, Gmail has its own, and most importantly, their search function had its own. So Google executives are saying what they're trying to do is simplify their privacy policies. Many of them were overlapping and similar in any case. Make it easier for consumers to understand how their information is being used, and they're combining most of those privacy policies into one. But the big change here is that in some key cases, they are going to start sharing information internally within Google between different services. So if you're a registered user, if you have a Gmail account or you have logged into a Google Plus account, and you go to the search page and search, they'll know that it's you searching. And your searches, what you're searching for, what you click on, will then be used to inform services, other services Google offers, and other ads that you see in those services.
Ads are the main feature here, right? This is really probably for most users going to be noticed with the ads, or is that accurate?
Not necessarily. You know, Google says that by allowing the company's different divisions and services to share information uniformly, they'll be able to offer a number of new types of services. So, for example, say if you go to Google Search and search for an address and then click on a map and get directions, and then you have an Android phone and you pick up your phone and you're in the car, they'd like to be able to ensure that those directions are right there on your phone as you're driving down the street so you don't get lost. So there are real opportunities here for them to leverage the kind of information they collect to offer new, more convenient things. Another example might be that they see on Google Calendar that you have an appointment, in my case, say, in San Francisco, you know, 45 minutes away, and they notice that there's a traffic jam because they're monitoring traffic on Google Maps constantly. They might tell me I should leave earlier or take a different route without me having to go and search out that information. They could push it to me. So those are some of the types of services that they're contemplating. With existing privacy policies, that was difficult for them to do. Now, all of that stuff is nice, but Google is a business, and Google is in the business of selling ads. So, you know, the motivating factor here, I think, you were right. It is to better sell ads, to sell more targeted ads, and to sell ads that really know who we are, what we're doing, you know, where we are, and ideally what we want at that moment. Those are really valuable ads for advertisers, and Google's in a pitched battle in that space right now.
And what's been the reaction to this from Google users?
Well, you know, it's hard to say because there are literally billions of them. Within sort of the privacy advocacy community, the reaction has been pretty negative and pretty intense. You know, privacy policy in the United States is basically based on a series of contracts. In very few cases are there overarching laws that tell companies what they can and cannot do with your information. So instead, we have this system of privacy policies where, you know, you go to a site, whether it's Google or Apple or Amazon, and you click on the terms of service. You probably don't read it, but you accept it. But what you're really doing is entering into a contract with that company, and that contract governs how they can use your personal information going forward. What Google's doing is taking millions of users and saying, we're going to change the terms. And we're going to change the terms not only for the information that we're going to collect about you going forward, but the information we collected about you in the past, you know, when you agreed to this contract, when the terms were different. And that, those types of changes have gotten companies in trouble with government regulators in the past. It's a tricky area to walk into. Now Google execs tell me that they have shared their plans with regulators not only in the United States but around the world. And while regulators are unlikely to give them a clear thumbs up or thumbs down, that they feel confident that these changes will pass legal muster. Nonetheless, you know, I think that they probably expect and should expect a really close, hard look, both from people within government and from sort of the advocacy community outside government.
And you mentioned these agreements. You know, people click through them. I'm guilty as well of, you know, when I'm registering new software or something like that, agree to the terms of service very quickly. Do a lot of people even tend to notice this? It seems like this policy and certainly some of Facebook's privacy issues have raised a lot of concern, and there's been a lot of talk around them. But for the average user, is it really something that there's any indication that they're thinking about or are concerned about?
You know, that's a really interesting question. Every few months, one of these big companies will get in a situation where it does something that really sort of provokes the ire of the public. But you look at sort of engagement with the services they offer, and there really haven't been that many examples of a privacy issue killing a business or really visibly injuring a business, at least that I'm aware of. So, you know, I think there are dangers here commercially for Google. If it starts using this information in a way that you know, to quote Ryan Kahlo, the director of privacy at Stanford Center for Internet and Society, if they use it in a way that creeps people out, then they're going to run into problems. You know, if you pick up your Android phone and you're surprised and kind of freaked out by what your phone knows about you or the ads you're seeing on it, that's going to hurt their business. Of course, the reaction from Google would be to try to stop that because they're a data-driven company. If they see ads are driving customers away, they're going to respond to that, I think, fairly quickly. So far, at least, I think the answer has been, you know, no, that this really hasn't had commercial implications for many of these companies.
And do you think that this this concern over these policies will lead to a change, or in a couple months do you think we may just have forgotten all about it and people will just be used to getting some more information or possibly more relevant or for some people more creepy results when they search?
I mean, that's a tough question. You know, predicting the future is always dangerous. But I think that Google will probably introduce a lot of services that a lot of people really like coming out of this. And I think that if they are forced to make changes, my bet would be it's not going to be because of a negative commercial reaction, but because regulators and privacy advocates look at the law, look at what they have done, and force them through sort of administrative reviews, either here or in Europe or elsewhere, to make those changes. But I don't think we're going to see changes come out of sort of a backlash from the public.
All right. Thank you very much, Steve Henn with NPR. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Sure thing. My pleasure.
Thank you also to Rick Edmonds with the Poynter Institute, to Brandon Smith with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations, also to Shelley Baskin with WKMS, our Kentucky Public Radio partner in Murray, Kentucky, and Kenny Colston, Kentucky Public Radio Capital Bureau Chief. Thanks also to the WFPL News Team, Philip Bailey, Erica Peterson, and Devin Katayama. State of the News is produced by the WFPL News staff. Our production team is led by Brad Yost and Laura Ellis. For more information, show notes, and full audio, visit WFPL.org. I'm Gabe Bullard.